This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Hip Hop Week on Fresh Air. Throughout the week, we're featuring interviews with some of the most important rappers and DJs of the past 30 years. All the rappers we'll hear from today, Daryl McDaniels of Run DMC, Chuck D of Public Enemy, and LL Cool J, launched their careers with the help of my first guest, Russell Simmons. He's probably the most famous and successful hip-hop entrepreneur and helped bring rap to the mainstream. In the mid-1980s, he co-founded Def Jam Records with music producer Rick Rubin. Here's just a few of Def Jam's hits.
I'm going back to Cali, Cali, Cali. I'm going back to Cali. I don't think so. Going back to Cali, styling, profiling, smiling, and smiling, while in the sun. The top is down on the black Corvette, and it's fly cause it's sitting on B. Brass monkey, that funky monkey. Brass monkey, junkie, that funky monkey.
Well, it was one of those days.
Not much to do.
I was chilling downtown
with my old school crew.
I went into a store
to buy a slice of pizza.
I bumped into a girl.
Her name was Mona. What?
Mona Lisa.
What?
Mona Lisa. So many.
So some stay illiterate and feed bull legally licked. You go the ways of the weasel.
The weasel. Pop pop goes the weasel. The weasel. Pop pop goes the weasel. The weasel. Pop pop goes the weasel. The weasel. Pop goes the weasel. Cause the weasel goes pop.
The minute they see me. I'm the epitome, a public enemy. Used, abused, without clues. I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
M-E-T-H-O-T, man. M-E-T-H-O-T, man. M-E-T-H-O-T.
The east side of the LBC. On a mission trying to find Mr. Warren G. Seen a car full of girls, ain't no need to tweak. All you search know what's up with 213.
This is how we do it. It's Friday night and I feel alright. The party's here on the west side. So I reach for my 40 and I turn it.
Before starting Def Jam, Russell Simmons produced rap concerts and managed performers including Curtis Blow and Run DMC. Simmons' younger brother, known as Run, co-founded the group. In 1999, Simmons sold his stake in Def Jam to the Universal Music Group for $100 million. He remains CEO of Rush Communications. When I spoke with Simmons in 2001, I asked what his reaction was in 1979 when he heard the first commercial rap record, Rapper's Delight, by the Sugar Hill Gang.
The hip, you don't stop. Rock it out, baby, rubber to the boogity bang bang, the boogie to the boogity beat. Now what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am...
1979, that record came out, and I was very distraught because I didn't know any better, and I had a record on the shelf by the name of Christmas Rapping, which was the first release that I was involved with by Curtis Blow. And so, you know, I didn't have the vision to know that this was an eye-opener for America or opened the door for me. I just thought that these guys had stolen my, you know, not my idea, but I had a record on the shelf, and I wanted it to be the first rap record. So when I heard it, I kind of, not only was I upset, but so was the whole hip-hop community, because there was a group of artists, DJ Hollywood, Eddie Cheeba, the great Grandmaster Flash, Curtis Blow, Love Bug Starsky. These guys were the stars of that genre, and they were performing artists. Now, here's a recording artist record by people who were not popular, who borrowed ideas and rhymes from this community and put it on record. So we were all, like, bummed out because we thought these guys had stolen our music, our ideas, and our, you know, our culture, and they were selling it, and we weren't. So I didn't realize that Rapper's Delight was the greatest thing that could have happened to me.
How was it the greatest thing?
Well, because it allowed people to understand that there was profit in rap music. And then it gave Curtis Blow an opportunity to put out his record. I had a Curtis Blow record on the shelf. Again, that record was named Christmas Rapping. It plays every Christmas right now.
Why don't we play it now? Introduce it for us. Tell us something about what you think made this record special.
Well, it was probably the second rap record to come out. And it was a very, very commercial version of hip hop, but it certainly it was honest. It was a hip hopper who was from Harlem. It was the real thing and had it built a legitimate following on his own as a performing artist. And whenever I hear it, I get goosebumps because that was my first experience of being in the record business, which was something, of course, I aspired to and, you know, only dreamed about.
Okay, so this is Christmas Rapping. It's Russell Simmons' first record production and Curtis Blow's first recording.
Twas the night before Christmas and all through the
house.
Hold
it now, wait, hold it. That's played out. Hit it.
You give me all that jive about things you wrote before I was alive. Cause this ain't 1823, ain't even 1970. Now I'm the guy named Curtis Blow, and Christmas is one thing I know. So every year, just about this time, I celebrate it with a rhyme. Gonna shake it, gonna bake it, gonna make it good. Gonna rock, shock, knock it through your neighborhood. Gonna ring it, gonna sing it till it's understood. My rap about to happen like a D. You were slapping or I thought you'd been tapping on a hunk of wood. Bought a red suited dude with a friendly attitude and a sleigh full of goodies for the people on the block. Got a long white beard, maybe looks kind of weird. And if you ever see him, he can give you quite a shock.
That's Curtis Blow's Christmas Rappin', produced by my guest Russell Simmons, who has a new memoir, which is called Life and Death. Now, when you started getting successful, and when some of the performers you were producing, like Curtis Blow, started getting successful, Run DMC, it meant money. Making money quickly at a young age can be a very good thing. It could also be a very destructive thing, because sometimes people aren't prepared to deal with that kind of money. And it gets them into more trouble than it has benefits. Looking back, what are some of the things you think you did right and wrong when you started coming into money?
Well, I think that I already was like a big old druggie. Like whatever drug came my way, I took. I was already running the street. The success or the money, the results of the success, I don't think it damaged me too much. You know, I mean, it gave me opportunity and access. Some of the access was a little bit of a problem, but I think that mostly I had a good time, and I think that the money for me was, you know, just gave me more incentive in a way. It was kind of a measure of success, but I did see many artists who got addicted to drugs and whose careers suffered because of this quick access and this amount of money that was, you know, for them an unreasonable amount of money for the work that they did. People did the work for the love of it, and when they started to get a lot of money for it, they lost focus, many of us. And so, at some point, you know, I just straightened up, and it was kind of an evolution, but it was just, I don't think that the money for me was a problem. I mean, it gave me the opportunity to get an apartment. I remember when Christmas Rapping was a hit, for instance, the greatest success that I can remember to date is that I got a record out. I got a chance to get on a plane and go to Amsterdam, which for me was an amazing experience. I had never been on a plane at all. I went to Amsterdam in 1979 with Curtis Blow. We were treated like, well, we thought we were kings. We got to go to Amsterdam and perform, and we saw people, you know, from other countries, not only Amsterdam, but we went to France, Paris, France specifically, and these people watched us perform, and here we were in this big world with our own music. And when I came back to New York, I was moving into my own apartment. That apartment is probably no bigger than the studios I'm here recording from. But I was in the record business, which is what I wanted to be, and that was a tremendous success, just the ability to go to work every day in an industry that I loved.
As a teenager, you were dealing drugs and making money that way. Did you learn anything in the business of dealing drugs that you were able to apply when you became a real businessman?
Well, I can tell you that it inspired me to buy for one and sell for two. And that's something that in the black community, we didn't have very many role models who were entrepreneurs. It's just now that hip-hop is inspiring so many young people, many of whom are not so educated or sophisticated, but driven by incentive and, I mean, by love of music and art, and who own their own, and there are big margins in some of these businesses, and they just go to work every day without you know, a business school background, without a degree from Harvard or wherever, to just go to work from heart. It's something that was not instilled in kids in the black community. Their job was to be a doctor, maybe, but be a teacher, probably. Just to go to school was the goal. You know, rappers rap now about being CEOs. They don't even rap sometimes about how good a rapper they are. They rap a lot more about how much they can stack money and how they do it. You know, how they run their businesses.
Now, do you think of yourself as having done business any differently with Def Jam than you saw business being done in the major record labels that you had tried to deal with?
Absolutely. We had this vision that these artists were long-term, that they had images of that had to be protected, that they were not going to be exploitative in terms of the kind of music they put out. We weren't going to change their music so it would sell more. We weren't going to sell them out or allow them to sell themselves out. We wanted to remind them to keep their integrity and promote that. We wanted to make sure that their images, their visual images, were out in the street, not just their music. There was a lot of work that we did that was different from what major labels would have done, and it gave us an edge over them, because even now, LL Cool J, who was our first act, and we recorded his record in 84, is recording a new record, and his last record was a platinum-selling record. Even now, there's a new Run DMC record being recorded, and their first record was recording in 1982. Beastie Boys are still recording. There's a new Public Enemy record. Slick Rick is still coming out. There's a new EPMD record. These are the bands we started with. You can always fool people one time or a few times, but to really have a long-standing career, you have to connect with them in some real place.
Have you ever been concerned about the promotion of a gangster lifestyle through rap, making it cool to think of women as bitches, making it cool to think of shooting people in drive-bys and the gang life?
You know, I'm often asked this question.
I figured. And,
and people are always surprised to know that I'm really proud of all of what rap stands for today. And I believe that what people say in their closed doors, they're shocked to hear it on the radio. They're shocked to hear a reflection of this reality, you know, broadcast. I heard a senator say at the hearings on the Marketing Accountability Act, and Senator Thompson, a Republican senator, said he thought that every 15-year-old boy should see Saving Private Ryan, because he thought that if they all saw that, they'd know a lot about the war and about, you know, that lifestyle that you have to, or that attitude that you know have to have in order to live through war, and it was important. Well, I said, well, in that case, every 15-year-old kid must hear a Snoop Dogg record, because that's a war going on down the block. And that's not 50 years ago, that's right now. And that's something that it's very important. When they say F the police, or when they said it in Compton in 1985, that was such an important record. I remember signing a band in L.A., and they were just nice kids, basically, but lived in a horrible part of L.A. And they came to visit me at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and they asked me how to get home. I said, what do you mean, how do you get home? How'd you? And I said, they're afraid of the police. I said, well, why are you afraid of the police? What are you carrying? Do you have guns? Do you have drugs? No, we don't have anything. We're just afraid of the police. He's a 20-year-old man, scared to drive in Beverly Hills. Almost all the records that people perceive as gangster records are about people frustrated who don't perceive themselves as having any other opportunity, and it's a description of their lifestyle more than it is an endorsement of it. And so that's something that, you know, people who listen closely to the music can tell, and people from the outside, all they can hear is the language. Well, real language is okay by me, and descriptions of real situations and a real reflection of our society, a part of our society, is important by me.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Russell Simmons co-founded Def Jam Records and is the CEO of Rush Communications. Our interview was recorded in 2001.